Working. Just say something.
Hello.
That was perfect. Good.
Is it something about us that stops these little mats here being filled? Is it personal? Don't be shy filling up these front mats. I challenge somebody to come and sit on one of these mats and make me feel slightly less remote from you. Come on, Tim.
I'd like sitting on a chair.
But you need a chair, yeah. Well done, Esme. Yeah. It does feel slightly strange. I find it slightly strange to sort of have a gap between me and who I'm talking to, so please don't be... It's not as if these are reserved for special order members or anything. Just because... Okay, so welcome back, everybody. Lots of people... who I can see who are here again, who've been following this series on spiritual death, but you're still alive. Tonight, for those of you who I don't know, there's one or two faces I don't know, I'm Surya Dyer, yeah? Tonight we're going to be following on from the three of the talks. What did we talk about the first week? We talked about... spiritual death generally, didn't we?
That was in relation to metta.
Then we talked about the illusion of control, if you remember, the illusion that we can't fix samsara. That was the next week. Last week, Bhadra led, first of all, a dana appeal, and then he led the stupa practice, the visualisation practice. This evening, I'm actually going to be talking about sangha, and... sangha as spiritual death, or at least how does spiritual death relate to the whole issue of sangha. But what I'm going to kick off with is just to step back to Bhadra's appeal last week. One of the things that we do as a sangha, one of the things that we take on as a sangha, one of the practices we take on, quite formally in a way, is generosity. As a conscious... action. And last week Bhadra made an appeal for dana. I'm just going to sort of reboot it because we would like some response. We're hoping for a generous response, and I just want to spread it again. It's very difficult to make these appeals. It's something that you got across very well last week. It's not particularly easy to ask people for money. But I'm going to remind us of a couple of things, that the reason that we're here is all because of other people's generosity. I'm going to tell you a couple of stories. This ash shrine was actually made by a lady craftsman who worked somewhere in the Mendips some considerable number of years ago. It must be 15, 20 years ago, Shredaloshini. And she actually got quite sick, I believe, while she was doing it. And as a result, the work took much longer. But she actually did it and made it for us at a very, very modest fee because she knew that we were a bit strapped. And even though she would have liked to have been paid substantially, and it's a beautiful piece of work, if you ever get a chance to look at it, it's a beautiful piece of work. She did it for us at a very, very modest price. And every time I look at it, I feel appreciation for that lady and what she did for us because I think it's a rather beautiful thing. This carpet that we're sitting on used to be the most amazingly florid, sort of psychedelic old number that was sort of encrusted with every conceivable thing that could possibly have been dropped on it. This was a carpet showroom, I believe, before we bought it. And the whole place was full of it, wasn't it, those of us that remember. And this carpet was actually bought by four guys who got together, clubbed together, and laid out quite a substantial amount to recarpet the entire place because they thought that it would make such a considerable difference. And I could go on. The whole place has been built on other people's generosity. The reason that we're here is because of other people's generosity. We haven't, you know, suddenly got shed loads of money that have fallen out of the sky. They've been small amounts, big amounts, but when you get in the back room and see what comes in, it's because of that. Because of that, and our confidence in the fact that we could operate out of generosity, we decided to become a dana economy and really trust that people could and should be generous. And for that reason, I would just reiterate our appeal from last week. Please, even if it's just a few quid that you just leave in the pot, it will make such a difference to us. And if you can play this forward as well among the rest of the Sangha and just reiterate that, we would be not only grateful, but it is a practice. It's one that I'm going to be talking about a bit more later on. There's a wonderful story about the Tibetan Rinpoche. I think it's Dado Rinpoche, who was the most modest, unassuming, gentle person. Gave up his life to teaching children in northern India. I think the story goes that a group of quite sort of important, spiritual attainment people were gathered together and visited a temple. And it's traditional in these times and circumstances to always give a gift. And these other Rinpoches and priests, or whoever they were, had forgotten to bring an offering, and they were deeply embarrassed as they came through the gates of the temple. And the story goes that Dado just reached into his pocket, and typically he had bought sticks of incense. He gave everybody incense. And he, for us, it probably seems quite trivial. For them, I think it was very, very important that they had something to offer, and he sort of retrieved the situation. It's that mindful aspect of generosity that I aspire to, anyway. We can all aspire to.
Sorry, before you go, sorry to come in, Suyodai. The other thing I'd really like to include is that when we're talking about generosity, it's not just financial generosity.
Yeah.
There's time as well. And Sangha Works offer us every Wednesday morning, and it would be great if anybody could give a couple of hours on a Wednesday morning. It really would be appreciated. We try to keep the place clean and tidy, and I think because of various people who aren't turning up tomorrow, we're going to be rather short staffed.
But it's fun, isn't it? It's fun.
Well, it's a great way to kind of just come together in, you know, be alongside each other in a different way. And the other thing, I was in here yesterday, and two people who, you know who you are, you know, came in, and these goddesses came in and just transformed the shrine by putting flowers on the shrine.
We know who.
And that happens weekly. Some of these two people are taking it on, and it just, you know, that's that contribution really creates the atmosphere, the ambience for all our classes. So very important, these small things. It doesn't have to be purely a financial response.
No.
Gratitude, generosity comes out in many different forms.
Likewise, I'm going to give a nod to Badra, because you can hear that he's not very well this evening. In fact, he's not very well at all, are you? And I happen to know that last week he did 4 nights on the trot, covering for people who were poorly and stepping up, and I know how shattering that can be, and held it together really, and then went off to Glasgow and did a whole session for the whole weekend as well. So that's a kind of generosity, really putting yourself out there with the energy. So appreciation to you and metta for your recovery. Anyway, the subject. So Sangha, spiritual death as Sangha. The practice of Sangha is spiritual death, I've called it. So we learn a lot about all these different practices in Buddhism, don't we? We learn about meditation and ethics and the cultivation of wisdom and so forth. And perhaps I think sometimes we omit to focus quite enough on the practice of Sangha as a practice. It's that I want to talk about a bit. I mean, it does come out of the other. The cultivation of wisdom is closely related. You know, the cultivation of wisdom, that is seeing things as they really are and not how we think they are, seeing things as impermanent, empty, unsatisfactory. And as I was talking about 2 weeks ago, the sort of corollary of that is that we don't see ourselves as a fixed, finite, boundaried entity, but we learn to see and experience ourselves much more as a sort of a fluid process that's constantly changing. This is one of the sort of root necessities of embarking on exploring spiritual death, this ability to just see ourselves as less fixed, as more connected. This is part of a wisdom practice, and it's dependent on the practices of meditation and the practices of ethics. They're both closely related. So we learn a lot about these other practices, and as you go along, I remember people were constantly sort of saying to you, how's your practice? You know, how's your practice? And I used to think, what are they talking about, my practice? You know, do they think I go home and play tennis or, you know, do the piano or something? I didn't understand what practice was. It's only gradually that one begins, don't we, to understand that this is practice. This is actually proactive doing of something in the pursuit of the transformation, the sort of fulfilment of what we want our potential to be. Yeah, so perhaps one thing that we neglect to look about quite so much as practice is Sangha and our relationships within the Sangha and how Sangha works for us and what Sangha can offer us and what we can bring to it as well. And I think many people have been saying in the order and outside more and more that we need to look at Sangha much more as working ground and view it as such rather than just as a sort of comfy add-on to our spiritual lives. We need to keep reminding ourselves that we are going for refuge to the three jewels, and that is the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, all three. And why is this? And more importantly, how does it relate to spiritual death? That I'll go on to talk about. But first, just a couple of definitions and some explanations that you may or may not have come across. And these are that there are two, in Buddhism, there are two primary meanings of Sangha. And the first one is the community of fellow journeyers, which is what we are here together now, here in Samsara. These would include our friends, our teachers, our students. But the second Sangha is what we call the Arya, or the noble Sangha. And this is the community of men and women who have been before us, many in history, and who have transcended that self-attachment that I've been talking about, who have, you know, gone beyond, who have achieved a state of liberation, many of whom have become our teachers. So they will include our teachers and our teachers' teachers, and they will track right back to the Buddha himself. And that is what we understand as being the Arya Sangha. Sangha in both its aspects operates in our lives, very much so, the Arya and also the relative, if you like. But it's the earthly Sangha that I'm going to talk about this evening. So firstly, why? Why Sangha? Why is it important? I think the answer to this is that we need other people to reinforce our desire to stay on this journey if we're really serious. Pretty much all of us will understand that we find it necessary to have fellow journeyers. It's pretty difficult. I'm sure people have and people will work in isolation, but for most of us, it's this support and love and care and all sorts of other things that can help us in times which can be very challenging. Without this kind of reinforcement, we're much more likely to sort of slip back into all our old views and all our old habits that we had before. You know, a lot of us can sort of come into this and get a whoosh of enthusiasm, and then very typically there's often a bit of sort of stepping back. You know, these are tricky times. Sometimes you need something to sort of push you back a little bit, put you back in. And in those times, friendship can be incredibly strong and powerful and just sort of hold you there. It takes us a long time, all of us. Of course it takes a long time to learn that materialism doesn't hold all the answers. And it can be so tempting, especially in trying times, for us to kind of get comfortable again. We need a community of fellow journeyers, I think. I mean, people who are on the same page to come together, to thrash out what the Dharma means, to be generous with each other and to help each other, but also, and very importantly, to challenge each other and to give permission to the other to challenge us. In other words, to open up to a deeper communication and to enable us to hold a light up to each other, to reveal and to explain and to help us kind of see stuff. And wonderful a spiritual friendship is, and it is a true gift, as I think probably all of you have sensed, and some of you know with a great deal of experience, we're all kind of at different stages. Wonderful as spiritual friendship is friendship in the context of a spiritual life. That's what spiritual friendship is, friendship within the context of a spiritual life. We cannot delude ourselves into thinking that we'll be a joy totally and always. If we deepen relationship with others, then we will inevitably be brought up against our own pride, our own self-clinging, our own stuff, and our egotism will collide with the egotism of others. It's just inevitable. It's practice ground. But in terms of spiritual death, I think Sangha and interaction with other members of the Sangha is one of the most powerful tools that we have for transcending ourselves. We're looking for a particular kind of intensity of engagement, where we make an effort to relate to others who are also making a similar effort to relate to us. It's a very proactive thing. So, one of the greatest joys of finding Buddhism for me was coming here and finding myself with a whole bunch of people who seemed to me to be on the same page with all my particular peculiarities and weirdnesses. It was kind of finally, for me, and I remember it clearly and still do, it was finally a place where I didn't feel like a square peg in a round hole. Now, isn't to say that my life had been miserable or, you know, a failure, or it's just the way it was. It never felt quite right with my experience of dukkha, you know, the ill-fitting chariot wheel that just didn't sort of quite fit. So instead of, I didn't feel like a square peg in a round hole. I thought this was a place where there were lots of funny-shaped pegs in lots of funny-shaped holes. But what was striking about it was that all of those things were so well held. This was a place to sit together, to be quiet, to share, to explore, to unfold, and to look deeper and have others look deeper with me. It was a place to share a lot of joy and also a lot of sorrow, but to growingly feel that all of that was held in this wonderful sort of crucible, a place for possible transformation. So anyone who's developed a network of friendships within the Sangha and gone on to deepen this will tell you that sooner or later there will be bumps. There will be bumps. It's just a given. But the fascinating thing is that as uncomfortable as these are, we come to learn, I think, that they really are the most instructive of all, and teach us more than anything else. They really bring us up against strong stuff. They really tell us a lot about who and what we think we are, about this self that we're constantly recreating. And the art of navigating these bumps, I think, is very closely bound up with spiritual death. And I hope I can explain this. So friendship groups can develop in all sorts of different ways here, as I'm sure you're all experiencing. This crucible is a wonderful place. I'll give you an example. About 6 years ago, I ran a foundation course with Pranyamati, and on that course there are about half a dozen people who are actually here tonight. And we kind of went forward into a friendship. After the course finished, all of us decided we wanted to stay together, and we wanted to get to know each other and share our mutual love of the Dharma and just deepen our friendship. And indeed we did. And we just kept coming together as a group, as we encourage other people to do after courses. And I think we got to know each other very, very well in many ways. And we shared an awful lot of fun and a lot of truth, a lot of pain. But we all deepened our connection. It's been quite striking that this group and other groups like it, I think it is my sense that that sort of deep sense of connection keeps people coming. It's something that brings people back, especially when the going gets really, really rough. And I mean, if I look back at that group and the time that we've sort of shared our friendship, we've been through an awful lot. You know, there's been a huge amount of things that have happened to people. There's been divorce and bereavement and separation and job loss and illness and you name it. But it's been a very, very supportive context, hasn't it, for holding that and going forward together in our spiritual lives, but also mutually supporting each other. It's a powerful bond. There are many, many sort of group contexts built into the Sangha and the Order, you know, ranging from the group that you might graduate into or sort of meld into after your introductory course, if you understand the importance of maintaining those connections. And then if you go further, you might join a Mitra study group, which is a study group, but it's equally a very important context for developing and deepening friendship. Later on, if you decide to be ordained, you join another group with people who also want to be ordained. And then, when you join the order, there's more and more and more and more. There's groups and groups and groups and groups. There's context for practice. There's context for practice. And after ordination, these groups, these connections continue in lots of different ways. There's what we call vertical friendship with people who are perhaps a little bit further along than us, or a good deal further along. There's horizontal friendships with people who are the same as us. There's friendships with people who are a little bit behind us in some ways, and I use the word advisedly. They're relative things, and they exist in a myriad of different ways, and they're mutually supportive and joyful. It's a powerful bond, and that's how I experience it. So what is it exactly that can happen in these networks, in these friendship contexts, to help me with my spiritual death? What is it that can help me let go of that sense of self, my ego clinging? So I'm going to just flash back to 2 weeks ago. You may remember when I was talking that I was saying that the corollary of accepting that everything is impermanent is this thing about accepting that there isn't a fixed Suryodaya. And I said things like, there isn't a fixed Suryodaya that needs to be asserted or justified or admired or protected or respected or liked or anything else. There isn't a fixed Suryodaya that needs all those things, but only a Suryodaya who's this constantly changing flux of conditions. And how much of my life have I spent trying to do all those things, you know, be respected? Try to be right, try to be heard, try to be recognised, to be a bit better than someone else, try to be impressive, try to be sure that I'm correct. I think that the way I like to think about this sort of selfing project that goes on is an analogy which occurred to me one day. It's like one of those ducks that you shoot in the fair, you know, you shoot these fair and the ducks sort of ping down, you know, and then they go boom like that, yes? You know what I'm talking about? The little yellow ducks that sort of float across the... I think that my experience of myself sort of pinging back up is a bit like those ducks. And what I've come to learn is that if somebody pulls a cord for me that I then experience a strong reaction to, you know, I feel angry, I feel indignant, I feel absolutely overjoyed, or whatever... strong emotion. It's like this duck has come back up, especially with negative emotions. Very simple example. When I first noticed this, my employer asked me if he could change my holiday dates. There was absolutely no reason why I was unable not to change my holiday dates. I didn't have any plans that summer at all, but I was really fed up that he was requiring something of me that I didn't want to give. And somewhere in there, there was a view that I was quite a senior teacher here, and, you know, I wasn't going to sort of defer to other people. I ought to get priority over them. My experience of it was just like a sort of a whole, you know, no, I'm sorry. I'd said no before I'd even thought about it, really. And when I got home and actually reflected, I thought, well, why? You know, what was the problem there? And, you know, I think that was a time where it was very clear to me that this sort of need to be recognised or... well, you hear what I'm saying. It was just like this duck came up. So my duck comes up a lot. I suppose my project is to make it lie down again, or help it lie down again. So what are the kind of practices that I can do, that we can do, that can sort of eat into this fixed sense of self that I want to just assert over and over again? Well, these are just a few. I'm just going to tell you a few that I just brainstormed, and there's so many more. But every time I do these things, I am effectively eating into my fixed sense of self. I'm experiencing a little spiritual death. So, for example, every time I admit that I am wrong or that I might possibly be wrong, I'm dying a little spiritually. Every time I apologise, and in a sense, apology, it's not necessarily... The issue of whether you're right or wrong is irrelevant. Apologising and saying you're sorry for hurting somebody and that they're suffering. Every time I tell the absolute truth, the real truth, instead of tweaking it in a version that perhaps suits my perception of what might be make life a bit easier. Every time I forgive somebody whom I feel has hurt me or wronged me in some way. Every time I don't make excuses, I'm just simple and direct and honest. Every time I enter a situation with trust, with optimism and trust and openness. Every time I recognise and freely admit that I've acted in a way that's brought suffering of some kind, however small, however great, to somebody else. Every time I put somebody else's needs and somebody else's wants just in front of my own. Every time I act with generosity. Good one. Every time I really listen to somebody without letting my own internal dialogue interfere, without seeking to come into this conversation. Every time I give them my full and free attention. Every time I truly empathise, instead of somewhere in me heaving a sigh of relief that that isn't actually me. Every time I am brave enough to express myself in a group like this, it's a killer giving these talks. You really render yourself very open, and it's a real, real practice. But of course, it's an easy practice because I know what my aspiration is. I mean, in a sense, if you're judging me as a rather inadequate and a speaker who's not getting it across, that's your problem, not mine. I'm trying to do my best, and I'm being brave enough and having the courage enough to sort of stand up and do it, even though I know it might fall short of a standard I might like to aspire to. That's a kind of spiritual death. Every time we reveal ourselves and don't hide ourselves. And finally, every time I make an effort to stay in communication with somebody who's upset me to some small degree or to some great degree, but just to stay in communication, not to shut off, not to shut down. It's a huge thing. That's spiritual death. That's the attenuation of my selfing project, in my opinion. There are these and so many more things. And where does this happen? It happens in Sangha. Sangha is the working ground. Sangha is the fertile ground to do all this. It's only in relationship that we can experience a lot of these things. If I have to apologise to my family, I'm talking about my historical family, or among old friends, or colleagues at work, then my experience is that there's a good chance that there'll be a number who will hear my apology and think, oh, jolly good, that means I was right. Good for me. If I apologise for something within Sangha, then I know, or I hope, that it will be received by people who are aspiring, who may not necessarily be quite there, but who are aspiring to listen sympathetically and non-judgmentally and perhaps help me to see why this has happened and how things could perhaps have been different, and who will try to forgive me and who will not appropriate my humility for their self-aggrandisement, which is something I've done a lot in my life, I think. So when we become order members, we take a number of vows. We make promises to ourselves and to our Sangha, and one of them is to always try to stay in harmony with Sangha, with our fellow order members in particular, and everybody else. And we also undertake a number of kind of practices, informal, more formal, which can be done within the context of Sangha. And I'm going to tell you about one of these, which is known as confession. And I do this confession every week with my closest friendship group of friends in the order. Now, at the outset, I must say, confession in Buddhism is utterly, totally different from confession in Christianity. It is not about living in fear of being cast down into a pit, you know, and inviting some sort of superior being to forgive me. There's no god or priest who's going to kind of absolve me. No, that is completely different. Confession in Buddhism is about bringing to the table something which I'm going to sort of engage with in a process that will enable me, firstly, maybe to openly admit and tell about something, a transgression, something I'm not particularly happy about, something I may be deeply ashamed about, that I sincerely don't wish to do again, and to trust that merely by opening up into that level of communication with loving friends will help, first of all, lead to a healing process and deepen my resolve not to do it again. If you've got a bunch of people who've witnessed to you, it's powerful. But more, that my friends can then reflect back to me stuff about how and why this might have happened, to help me understand, to help me unpick it, to look at the conditions that led to it, and to really deeply consider the consequences that might evolve from it. So instead of just you and your limited perspective, you've got suddenly this whole kaleidoscope of perspectives around you, and experience, lots of wisdom, and above all, lots of compassion and kindness. And what this leads to is to assist me to kind of see more clearly where my old samskaras and habits might have contributed. So samskaras are these deeply ingrained habits that just go round again and again and again. Or even more importantly, that I might have some underlying view or opinion or idea that also contributed. So let me give you a couple of examples of this. So I'm thinking now of a good friend whom I've known over quite a time, and this particular friend has a bit of a thing with wanting things, a bit of sort of materialistic thing. It's something that she wants to get on top of. If she needs comfort, then she'll turn to, you know, charity shop bombardment, or maybe not buying the one thing but the second or the third thing kind of thing. It's buying stuff. It's her stuff. And this is a samskara that's just, you know, gone on for her for years and years and years and years. But it's something that I've witnessed her work with so powerfully over the years, and to the point where she's, you know, pretty much sort of seen through it. But in terms of view, what we've been able to do is to sort of show her gently and explore with her where this might come from. And one of the places this comes from is an idea, something in Buddhism we call a poverty mentality, this sort of sense that you haven't quite got enough, that you haven't got enough money, you haven't got enough supplies, you haven't got enough resources, which is so strong for many of us. And understanding where that's coming from, you know, it might be a conditioned childhood response. It could be from other sources as well. Another example is somebody who perpetually undertakes too much, you know, overreaches, overstretches, all out of a wish for generosity and kindness and a belief that this is the right thing to do, but then depletes herself, tires herself out, exhausts herself and overstretches. And it's something that she has wanted to really explore and understand. And one of the sort of things behind this, we've kind of tracked back, is the fact that she, as a child, didn't feel very seen. You know, she is a busy, busy childhood, and she probably got a little bit sort of passed over. Or, well, I don't know what the reasons were, but this sense that she wants to be seen. So these are the kind of underlying things that are driving. So this is what something of what Views is about. This whole view thing, which is the next thing I want to talk about a bit, is vitally important in the spiritual life. If we are not working to identify what the fixed views that determine so much of the way that we act and feel and are, then we're not going to get very far. Because in a sense, everything we do is sort of seen through this prism of fixed views and perspectives that we have about who we are and what our lives are. So briefly and swiftly, views come from different sources. You know, at one level, they might be very broad. They might be dictated. They might have evolved from our culture. You know, for example, once upon a time, our culture was a Christian culture, and that very much influenced how people acted, what they did, where they went, what they thought. People's views about sin very much dictated how they acted and reacted. And then, of course, after Christianity in this country, you can see the rise of industrialization and then evolution and then the questioning of all those old views and this big sort of turnaround. And those are the big things that are sort of behind us. Then comes materialism and capitalism and where we are today. And you can see how all these things will affect the way we are. And then views happen on a much more personal level and are the result of our personal history and our psychology, maybe our conditioning. We might have a hang-up about authority, for example, that might track back to something in our early childhood experience, or even later. We might be a bit of a hypochondriac and not have confidence and faith in our health, with no actual basis for it, but we're just sort of stuck in that view. My own set of views that I just have come to sort of habitually recognise now are, number one, I don't have as much energy as other people. I mean, clearly it's not true, but that's what I've believed all my life. I will not have the energy to last me the day. And number two, I absolutely cannot do computers. But I've come to sort of see over the years that it's not that I can't do computers, I don't want to do computers. They're very different things. Another one, I don't really belong. You know, I'm not. Is this really my place? I mean, interestingly, I do feel that I belong here. But and in a sense, if I really believe these things, that I don't belong, that I can't do computers, I'm going to find hundreds of different ways to reinforce them. I'm going to find lots of ways in my life to reinforce my conviction that I can't do computers. I'll sort of try and do something for 2 seconds, and when it goes wrong, I'll just give up, shout at it, and get somebody else to come and help me. I have a view that I'm fundamentally unlovable, that goes right back to my very, very early childhood and a couple of incredibly busy parents who probably didn't have the time or recognise the importance of showering me with affirmation. But though I may have gone through my life had so many successes and so many friendships, deep down in me there's this sense that if somebody loves me, there must be something a little bit wrong with them, because they haven't really seen just how. But I know that this is a view, and I've been helped to sort of see this view, and I've been helped to see how this view holds me back. And the reason for that is because partly study, a lot sangha. The thing is that these views can sort of hang around like low-level viruses, I think, in our lives, and we often don't realise them until somebody challenges them or shines a light on them. And it often takes a good friend who knows us well and who recognises our patterns, but who doesn't judge us by our patterns. So I will be eternally grateful to the likes of Satchalila, Dharma Vajri, Shraddha Lochani, Jvala Malini, Daya Jyoti, for doing this for me, and over and over again over the last number of years, just helping me see that, see those things. Okay, I'm going to finish very shortly. You'll be relieved to hear. There's just a couple more things that I want to talk about. Practices, these are. And the first one is a willingness to stay in communication. I mentioned this before. I just really want to sort of mention this one because I think it's so important. To stay in communication with people with whom we've fallen out, whether that's a massive falling out or even a little one, and we just can't be bothered to send that acknowledging text message. This can be so very, very difficult if we feel that we've been hurt or wronged or misrepresented or lied about or left out and all manner of other grievances. But these things arise constantly in our everyday lives, I think. They are the stuff of human experience. And in a sense, the whys and the wherefores of what happens are one thing. But the other important thing is whatever's happening, whatever, you know, whoever thinks they may be right, whoever thinks they may be wrong, we can still stay in communication. We can still, you know, send a text at the end of the day that says, whew, that was painful, it's difficult, but I hope you sleep well. You know, this sort of stuff. We can speak to somebody and say, I'm sorry. Not, I'm sorry I was wrong. You may firmly believe that you were right, but you can say, I'm sorry that we feel like this. You know, let's just keep at this. It's to keep open to the possibility that you may not entirely understand what happened and that you may not know the deep background to what happened. You certainly will not have known everything that was going on for that person at that time. So other people can often see this for you, perhaps, and help you do this. I've witnessed in my life people not speaking for days, weeks, and even years, actually just blocking out. And I suspect many of us has. I think it's an incredibly sad thing, you know, this not being willing to forgive and move on. And in my opinion, if we haven't got this, then if we haven't got that forgiveness, openness and willingness to accept responsibility are important, then we haven't even stepped onto the spiritual path, really. If we're stuck in a big sort of strong wall of resentment and self-justification, self-righteousness, then we're stuck in one whole big pile of selfing. It's huge and it's important. You can see it happening, you know, right here around you. You can see it in our workplaces. You can see it in the government. Goodness knows, if you look at what's happening with Brexit, I mean, you know, this is just shed loads of people who all think that they've got absolutely the right sort of view and it's necessary. And this very pernicious, dangerous thing, this certainty that my way is the best way. And I've seen it in the Sangha as well. And in a sense, it's a bit of a sort of a paradox. It's because we're arguing about what we teach in the Dharma or what we do with the Dharma, we get right, well, it's Buddhism and it's this way. And because it's Buddhism, it's important that I really get behind it and really insist that it's my way. But that's absolutely fundamentally counter to the teaching. It's interesting. So it doesn't just sort of fall away when you enter the spiritual life, far from it. But it's one to really watch for, I think. And the last thing I want to talk about, which is bringing me on, this brings me on nicely to this last point, which is going beyond preferences. And again, within Sangha, I think the practice of going beyond preferences is an incredibly useful, practical, but important thing that we can sort of leave behind, that we can forget. What I'm talking about with going beyond preferences is whatever choice we're faced with, we don't sort of forcibly head towards the thing that seems to be the best decision for us necessarily, yeah? So something as simple as, you know, there's five chocolate biscuits and there's one cake, but you take a chocolate biscuit because you know somebody else wants the cake. That's a fairly sort of pathetic example. But what have I written down? Oh, here's a good one. I saw this recently. Walking into a room and immediately going and taking the most comfortable seat, even though you know somebody is going to come in shortly who's got a very arthritic leg and probably will benefit from having that seat. That's an interesting one. You know, not arguing with the stewardess when she says you can't take your hand luggage on. What's the problem? You know, it's just going to go, it's just going to be a few more minutes, isn't it? You know, accepting gracefully when there isn't any choice on the menu. Thinking about Brexit and thinking that maybe a customs union deal may not be possible after all. There's lots of interesting things that I've heard about being done on retreat in relation to this. One of them I actually experienced myself, which was where the guy who was running the retreat down in Glastonbury made us all prepare our breakfast, and lots of us had porridge. You know, my particular preference is for raisins and coconut and cinnamon and brown sugar and blah, 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 blah. Really looking forward to this porridge. Everybody's got their breakfast. He got us all to sit down, he got us all to say thank you, and then he got us all to move to the left. And I mean, you should have heard the protests. It was so interesting. It's, what? You're going to make me eat something I didn't choose? You know, horror. All sorts of funny things. Another one I heard was on a women's retreat centre where they actually got the retreatants to put somebody else's clothes outside the door, the bedroom door of that person, so that in the morning they step not into their clothes but somebody else's clothes. But the interesting thing, I mean, they might sound rather laughable, the interesting thing about these practices is just how much you notice how that duck goes, no, you know, I want things kind of my way. It's a big one. It's really, really one to think about. It's going beyond preferences. Of course, there are times when you do have to stay firm. There always are. It may well be that, you know, your preference or your choice is going to affect somebody's health or well-being. It's all a question of deciding when it's just the duck going ping and when there's something really, really necessary. Is it really necessary? So when we speak about going for refuge, just to conclude, when we speak about going for refuge, we go for refuge to the Dharma, to the Buddha and to the Sangha. So let's remember that. Sangha as a practice. We go to the Sangha for fellowship and support and guidance and a whole host of other things. And finally, it's in the spaces that are created in those real friendships, I think, that something else arises. That's my experience. It's in those sort of moments of deep trust, most especially if you've battled and then you've fallen out and then you've come back. You know, that is such an incredibly joyful experience to re-establish a loving care and communication and connection with that person that you've been in pain with. And my experience is it actually deepens. It deepens it. It doesn't make it shallower. It makes it stronger because, hell, you've kind of seen that person's warts. And you've gone back in there for it, with it. So it's in those spaces that something else arises, that kind of, we were talking about the Dharmakaya, where other things come in. And the practice of friendship, the practice of Kalyana Mitrata, spiritual friendship within the Sangha, is one that can lead to all sorts of other ineffable and wonderful things that sort of move us on in this path to self-transcendence and spiritual death. Okay, that's it.
Thank you very much.
I'm sorry that's gone on rather longer than I had planned. But we are going to go now into those three groups. There are quite a few of us, so we're going to have... Are there any big...
Four groups.
Women in here, but if there's a lot of women, we might ask you to sort of come in the middle as well. Mixed group in the middle room.
In the bookshop area.
Bookshop area for any people who, you know, who are relatively...
Relatively.
The intro course people. And then with Taranita... into the other room for the men's group. Okay? And the question is, what spoke to you in this talk? What spoke to you? Yeah? Okay. Okay, good. Thank you.